Good evening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist, licensed counselor, and marriage and family therapist. Our topic this evening is going to be sex addiction, and joining us as our guest, we have licensed professional counselor and certified sex addiction therapist, Mr. Clint Davis. I want to invite our listeners to call in with questions or comments. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. So, Clint, will you tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I have a private practice called Clint Davis Counseling. There are six therapists that work with me, and we partner with the Hub Urban Ministry. We see clients from all kinds of different backgrounds. We treat children from the age of 3 to 12. We see adults, couples, individuals. We're trained in EMDR. We're really focused on trauma and obviously sex addiction.
So would you explain what EMDR is?
Yeah, EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a tool that is used by clinicians to help people who have a history of trauma to overcome their symptoms. So if you have been in a car wreck and you don't want to drive anymore, you find yourself being anxious, you can use EMDR to help you to be able to lower those symptoms so you can drive again. I mean, that's a pretty simple explanation for it. There's a lot more that goes into it than that. But it's just a way. Frances Shapiro, who came up with it, she realized when she moved her eyes back and forth that when she thought about her early childhood trauma, that it lowered her symptoms. And so she started looking at the way the brain works and the way that the brain functions around trauma. And so if you do this bilateral stimulation, it allows your brain to heal in the way that it wants to. And a lot of times our brain is trying to protect ourselves and be in fight or flight. And so we can't really get it to stop. And doing the bilateral stimulation allows us to kind of check ourselves out and slow ourselves down and process in a way that we're not allowed to. It's kind of like REM sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Your eyes are closed and your eyes are moving back and forth, and it's a way to process all the stuff from the day that your brain just can't take in, and it's a similar thing to do while you're awake.
And you also mentioned the Hub, which is a great organization, and their purchase program. So anytime that I get a chance to mention them, I like to. So tell us a little bit about the Hub and the purchase program.
Yeah, so the Hub is the umbrella. We have the Lovewell downtown, which we help with poverty and homelessness. We have a day program where people can come in. They have a card and they join and they can come in. And we have the Dress Well where they can get clothing, the Smell Well where they can wash their clothes, the Eat Well where they can get food. And it's on a point system. So they come and they can get a GED. They can work. They can do a class on knitting or sewing or some kind of whatever's going on during the day, and you get points, and then they can come back and use those points for those benefits. So I really like that part of it. It's trying to build, empower people, give them the tools they need. So like at Christmas, we do a Christmas gift where people donate gifts, and then people can come in and at a very discounted rate buy their kids toys. So instead of giving toys away, we empower the parents to say, no, you have money and you can, you know, buy these toys or use your points or whatever. And then purchased is our other side of it. And it is for women who are in human trafficking. So we have a juvenile program called Rejuvenate. And then we have a adult program called Purchased. And so we just finished our first year 2 weeks ago. We've been open for 4 or 5 years, but we rewrote the program and have had a full year of our 2 year intensive program. And so it's going really well. Women are staying longer. It's trauma informed. So they get addiction classes, therapy, yoga. And so Clint Davis Counseling, all of us treat all of those, the Hub, the Lovewell, and the Purchase Ministry for free, so no charge. And then we do about 12 groups a week for them as well.
Yeah, and I've met some of the ladies that have been through that program, and it's really seemed like it was very beneficial to them. So it's it really seemed like a great program to me.
Yeah, to be honest, you know, both of those opportunities are so much more of a gift for me than they are even what we give them. I learned so much more and so much humility. And just yesterday, we had a lady who's been a year sober, and, you know, so just getting to see her excitement and her tears and feeling loved and validated and worthy, there's nothing better than that. So
I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on sex addiction. Call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So we'll get to what exactly sex addiction is in just a minute. But first of all, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about prevalence. How prevalent is sex addiction?
So like most things, research is skewed. So with alcoholism, with drug addiction, people are a lot more free to talk about those things. You know, I think if somebody is like, hey, I've been, you know, sober for a year from alcohol, people stand up and clap and are excited. And, you know, they're like, that's incredible. And if you're, but if you say, you know, I've been sober from watching porn or sex addiction or prostitution for 6 months, you know, people are going to not usually stand up and clap. So yeah. I think our information on it is not as good as we'd like it to be, but somewhere around 12%. I read somewhere, you know, a while back, that's somewhere of upwards of 30 million people in the United States that struggle with sex addiction. So it's really prevalent.
I mean, yeah. And you and I were talking before we started the program, and, you know, just meeting with clients for other reasons, you often discover that there are a lot of people out there walking around that don't realize that they have a sex addiction or a pornography addiction, or, you know, and never really dawned on them, or they might realize that it's problematic, but they never really, it was never really addressed.
For sure.
Them.
Yeah. Nobody, a lot of people don't ask how many times you watched porn in the last month.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here for my marriage, or I'm here for, mm-hmm. you know, my anger management. And they don't see the connection of that addiction, or their lack of ability to get to it, or whatever is causing, you know, secondary issues.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really high. You know, I don't know what I would say the prevalence in my practice is, but, you know, I think the statistic in the last month, 83% of Protestant males have viewed pornography. So that doesn't mean they're all sex addicts, but it means the prevalence of us seeing this stuff is just, and, you know, we'll get into that later in mm-hmm. in the topic, but just how prevalent it is, sex and all those things are in our community and our culture. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
it's very accessible.
Yes.
Yeah. So in mental health, in psychology, you know, we have this big book of disorders that we use to diagnose people. And there's a lot of different what we call paraphilias, which are sexual disorders. But sex addiction is not listed as one of those disorders. So we don't really have a firm diagnostic criteria, official diagnostic criteria for sex addiction. So how do you determine that someone has a sexual addiction? You know, what are the signs? What are the symptoms? What are you looking for? What's normal sex and what's abnormal?
For sure. It's not in the DSM for a lot of reasons. You know, our moral culture, our judgment, it's one of those things that, you know, we don't talk about. In 1983, I think, is when Patrick Carnes and people started coining the term sex addiction. But I'll talk about a couple of, like, the way that we as CSATs kind of view what is sexual addiction and how would you label it that. First, I would say I don't personally worry so much about labeling it as sex addiction. I usually call it it's an intimacy disorder. So it's an issue with intimacy. It's not necessarily, it's definitely not about the sex. So even if it's prostitution or masturbation or pornography, you know, it's a gateway into dealing with intimacy. So the disorder, even though it's an addiction, is more about intimacy. And when you give, you know, the DSM is a great thing to label and know how to treat, but it also can stay with you for a long time, and insurances can dictate it and how much they get paid and all these things. So some of the ways we measure it is sexual preoccupation to the point of obsession. So it's not, you know, if I asked you, like, how many times you think about sex today, it may be once or twice. You know, I may say three or four, whatever. That's a normal, you know, somewhere in the normal span. 10 might be in a normal span. But when it's such a preoccupation that it becomes an obsession and it's all you think about, then it becomes concerning. Then a loss of control over sexual urges, fantasies, and behaviors, typically evidenced by failed attempts to quit or cut back. Right. So not only is it you're thinking about it all the time, but you continue to do it, continue to act in ways that you don't want to act. And it starts to get you in trouble, which is the third, right? Negative life consequences. So, you know, broken relationships, broken jobs, these sorts of things. And yet you keep doing it, mm-hmm. right? That's where the addiction comes in. And so there's, you know, a lot more in the history and history taking and all that we use, but it's not one of those. It's, you know, all of those. If you're just obsessing every day, that doesn't make it a sex addict. But if you're obsessing, then you're having impulse control issues and doing things you don't want to do. And those consequences are costing you everything in your life. And yet you still keep doing those three things. Then it becomes a problem.
Sure. So I talked a little bit about the paraphilias, which are like voyeurism and frotteurism, which nobody knows what that is.
But yeah.
It's a thing.
There's a lot of those isms.
Yeah. So how do those paraphilias that we have identified, how do they differ from sex addiction, or do they differ?
Yeah, I would say they differ. Those are typically about things, not non-human issues, where this is more about the human connection. It's more about not knowing how to be intimate with another person. We live, and I'm not saying I coined this phrase, but we live in a culture of sexual neglect. You know, I was doing a talk last week, and I was looking at ACEs scores. You know, these are adverse childhood, you know, situations. And so there's not a sexual neglect section. And I looked at it, I was like, wow, there's emotional neglect and physical neglect. But there is a thing that I believe called sexual neglect. You know, I have a 3.5-year-old little boy right now, and I teach him how to cross the street. Right. So I give him context. I say, hey, this is the sidewalk. This is the street. These are the stop signs. There are cars on the street. And when you walk across the street, you can get hit by a car. And that's why we don't do it. And so I give him context for that. So when you're a parent and you're not taught, you don't teach your children about masturbation, about menstruation, about pornography, about safe ways to use the internet and cell phones. And I know we're going to get into that later too. But, it's like teaching your kid no rules about the street. What's going to happen? Right? They're going to get hit by a car. And for children who view pornography, you know, and walk into these sexual situations, you know, they're getting hit by neurological cars that change them instantly. Mm-hmm. And so it's neglectful. You would call me neglectful as a parent if I didn't teach my kid how to eat and how to drink and how to walk across the street. It's the same way. And so we live in this culture that's just, you know, neglected around sex. And then we wonder why people don't know how to be intimate with each other.
Yeah.
And especially now with teens, all they've ever seen is pornography, you know. And so their view of sex and intimacy is totally skewed, you know, between mine and yours.
Yeah.
Because we lived in a time where it wasn't instant.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we often teach our kids about the mechanics, but not the other stuff.
Right.
Which is if we do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're always there. You hear, you know, see movies and jokes, and it's like, oh, you had the talk, you know, you had the birds and the bees talk, and they say it as like it was one time if they had it.
Yeah.
We had that one talk, and I told you where to put what and what was what.
Yeah.
And so, and that's usually because we have our own history and our own insecurities and our own shame around sex. You know, if we're talking about, you know, addiction, but, you know, when all this, you know, the Me Too movement that's going around, you know, the high rate of abuse and, you know, sexual misconduct and all those things that we don't know are also playing into all of this.
I just want to let listeners know that we are talking about sex addiction this evening, so this might not be the best show to listen to with your young children. So just want to give that little disclaimer that we will be talking about mature content this evening. And I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on sex addiction. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So what, and you kind of talked about this a little bit, but what is the difference between a high sex drive and a sex addiction?
Yeah, high sex drive. So that's going to be depending on the couple. Again, I think a lot of it is, how is it on an individual basis, how is it functioning in your life? How is it congruent with your belief system? So, you know, some couples might, on just a healthy level, you can't say, well, as a therapist, I can't say, well, you need to have sex 4 times a week. That's healthy, right? Or that's normal. I have to say, what's congruent for y'all as a couple? I have to teach the couple how to say, you know, no, 2-3 times a week, like, that's more than enough, and I'm perfectly happy with it. 1 time a week, once a month. Like, but if both people are completely happy with it and they're being honest and truthful and, you know, intimate, then there's no judgment for me to say that's healthy or not. And it's the same way. A lot of times, you know, these things, they start happening, and we, you know, we don't know, and we're not talking about them, we're not open about them, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're in the middle of it, and we don't know how bad it is. And so, you know, I would say it has to be a basic, you know, individual basis on, you know, what's high sex drive and what's addiction. But usually, like, we can have a high sex drive, and guess what? We need to have some self-control. You know, I tell my clients all the time, no male has ever died from not having an orgasm. You know, like, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between having patience and learning tolerance and self-control. And that may be something that in a marriage you may always have to deal with. There always may be an imbalance. We, you know, we think of marriage as fairness. You know, like, well, we're going to make this fair. You get this and then I get this and da-da-da-da. But the reality is there are so many seasons in a 50-year marriage, if that's what we're committing to, that it's going to be unfair. You know, we're not going to have sex that much. We're not going to be connected. I'm going to work more. You know, you're going to work less. The kids are going to be little, you know? And so I think measuring, for me, it's measuring what's healthy, not what's normal. You know, we were talking about it last week, like this idea of common good and common decency. And that's assuming that the majority of things are good, that the majority of people are, you know, healthy. And we look at marriage and say, what's a normal marriage? And I always tell people, I don't know, bring them in here and let me know, you know, show me what's normal because there's such a wide variety. I want to know what's healthy. So in this, like if you come in, if you're like, I'm struggling, I'm wondering what's going on with me, then you're already thinking it's costing me something. Right? There's a consequence. There's something that I can't handle that continues to interrupt my life. It might not be addiction, but it may be compulsivity or impulse control.
Yeah. So sure. If it's working in your marriage and it's not impacting your daily functioning, then that's not problematic. But if it is impacting your marriage, if it is impacting your daily functioning in a negative way, then that's problematic.
For sure. And that dictates what your spouse says too. Sure. 'Cause you may be sitting there saying, oh no, it's not, you know, messing anything up. I'm perfectly fine with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I can watch porn every day. I can still have sex with my wife and it's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And your wife may not say anything negative, or your husband, but that doesn't mean that's necessarily what she thinks. So I'm saying from a clinical standpoint, until I have somebody in the room, both spouse and husband, you know, and wife saying, I'm good, this is great, here's my history, here's what we worked through, then I'm like, well, why are you in my office, right? I mean, that's usually not the case.
Sure, yeah, because oftentimes I'll get individual clients in and they'll be talking about relationship problems or things like that. And have you talked to your spouse about this? Well, no. Okay, well, that's a good place to start.
Right, definitely. Yeah, or how many times does your husband like having sex that many times a week, or does your wife? Well, I don't know. We've never talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I tell teenagers all the time is, you know, I'm not going to tell you to be abstinent because you might not. But if you can't talk about sex before, during, and after, then you shouldn't be having it.
Yeah.
And how many marriages do we do that? Do we say, is that comfortable? Do you want to do this? Is this something that you like? Do you want to try this? And then how was that? Mm-hmm. You know, usually not.
Yeah.
And so that hosts, you know, a whole bunch of problems.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller. We have Mark from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
I was wondering if there were evidence-based treatments for sexual addiction such as pornography that have shown greater efficacy than like supportive therapy, and if so, kind of what's the outline for these types of treatments, and maybe how does that differ from things like alcohol addiction or quitting cigarettes?
Okay, good question.
Yeah, so evidence-based treatment, basically what we do as CSATs is we take you through, you know, workbooks, material, family history, look at your trauma history, and then we would like you to be in a 12-step group. We would like you to be in an addicts group, building a community of support. So, you know, that's kind of the basis of the first year. The second year is usually unpacking, you know, the recovery itself and figuring out like what all this means, because it takes about 40 days for your brain to actually start to even recognize that you're sober, and then 90 days after that to actually start to be able to heal. So a lot of times you get in this treatment modality, you get in group, you have other people around you who normalize it, who empathize with you, who don't make you feel isolated and disconnected. And then you get in with a therapist who doesn't look at like you like you're a leper. And that connection and that intimacy is a model for how you can be with other people. And it might be the first time that somebody's actually had intimacy in a way that's not sexual. Because again, it's an intimacy disorder. It's not really about the sex. It's about a person not knowing how to be intimate with another human being because there's been violations of the safety and love early on. So that's our treatment modality. There are, you know, when people come to my office, if I'm seeing them once or twice a week, and they keep relapsing and they keep relapsing, then I amp it up, right? I say, okay, two times a week. Okay, they're relapsing. Then I say, well, maybe you need to go to more groups a week. And then at a certain point when it's not productive, then there may be some inpatient way of treating it. There's all kinds of inpatient variables from $50,000 to $100,000 to free to subsidized. So, you know, but group, individual treatment, if you have a spouse, couple support, so having that spouse come in and learn about addiction and then deal with their own trauma, because a lot of times what we see is staggered disclosure. We see a spouse, get, you know, come in and they say, hey, you know, I found out this about my husband. He said this was all there was. And then 2 months later, I found this. And then 3 months later, I found this. And that's very traumatic. And then we have another term called gaslighting where, you know, somebody says basically they don't catch them doing anything, but they continue over and over again to see the ramifications of this addiction. And the spouse is going, wait, I can't, I got my finger right on it, but like, I can't prove it. And now I feel insane. And now I'm the bad guy. And then after it all comes out, it's like for 6 months, you've been doing this. So that those two treatments of working with the family holistically, making sure people are in group, making sure people are getting individual therapy specifically around sex addiction, and getting trauma, therapy as well. That's kind of the proven way of doing it. I don't really know any other way of treating it.
Well, and unfortunately, this is a pretty new area of research. There just isn't that much research out there, and especially pornography. There's some research, but it's just not a whole lot. So we're unfortunately kind of feeling our way in the dark, and this is
for sure.
Yeah.
There. I mean, as far as CSATs, I'm one. Well, now Whitney on my staff is, and then I know you work with sex addicts, but there's probably really three or four of us in Shreveport total that would do this full to part time.
Yeah.
And there's, a lot more sex addicts than that in 250 square miles of Shreveport. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have people that drive from Longview and Dallas and Texarkana and Alexandria. And so, the need is huge. Mm-hmm. And the research isn't great. So, Mark, that's the answer I got for you, man. Come in and get some therapy, or have your friend come in, or whatever.
So you said two things that I'd like to, because I'm sure that there were some of the listeners that were like, whoa, wait a second. You said in the first year we do this, and in the second year, and I'm sure there's some listeners that are like, whoa, wait a second. How long does this treatment last?
For sure. So it's typically a 2.5 to 3 year process. You know, and that sounds intensive and it's a lot, but I can guarantee your addiction is costing you way more than that financially, emotionally, long term. A divorce is pretty expensive. The cost it has on your kids and your grandkids and your life forever is super expensive. And so, you know, there's a lot of resistance to that. And my thing to that is people, when they're ready, that doesn't matter. When you're out of denial and you're ready to get help and you come in and you hear the material and you get loved on and you get walked along beside, when you've been in a culture that's shaming, you have a history of shame, you have a history of trauma, you know, from what I see in my clients after 6 months, even though it's really hard, you know, it's a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh, okay, this is life. And to be honest, for all of us, recovery is great. I read this article the other day that said, like, reasons why to date a sex addict that's been in recovery. And it's just talking about the integrity and the depth and the loyalty and, you know, the truthfulness and all these things, because they've learned to be a person that we should all be striving to be.
Yeah. And when we're treating sex addiction, you know, it doesn't just jump on you from out of nowhere.
No.
You know, I mean, there's a history there. There's a reason that there are intimacy deficits. There may be trauma or other issues that have to be addressed. So it's not just stopping the behavior. It's healing the past that has caused this behavior.
For sure. Yeah, we focus, you know, we were talking about this earlier too. Like, we focus so much on behavior, on what you're doing. And sex is something that, you know, we have a hard time with because we judge it so much more rigidly than other things like food. You know, we have an epidemic of food addiction in this country that we don't talk about. You know, sugar and fats and, you know, McDonald's and these things that just they're not just like we just do it every once in a while. We have to have it. We have to get it, you know. And we joke about it, like, you know, we bring the worst food to parties and we bring the worst food to Bible studies and we bring, you know, and we are like, oh, well, this isn't gluttony. This is just what we do. Mm-hmm. And both of my sons have food allergies. And so I've been made more aware of food addiction just from the fact of, like, everywhere we go, it's all about the food that you bring, and not just eating a little bit, but eating a lot. And you see the coping and the emotional, you know, and we're like one of the only countries that has the dessert cart. Right, because he asked about earlier, what's the difference kind of between behavioral addiction and chemical addiction, mm-hmm. right? Drugs versus sex. And, you know, we do the dessert cart because it's about how it's presented. A cocaine addict doesn't care what his cocaine is bagged in. right? But a sex addict and a food addict cares specifically how it's dressed up, the type of role that it plays in their life, because it's about relationship. It's about survival. Mm-hmm. You know, drugs, alcohol, they're not about survival. They're about functioning. Or sex and food, they're very much about, like, I have to have this. They're on the Maslow's hierarchy of need. And so, but we don't talk about them.
So, again, I want to remind you listeners that this is a mature topic. We are talking about sex addiction. So perhaps not the best program to listen with your young children. So just want to give that little disclaimer. And I want to invite our listeners to join in the conversation with a question or a comment on sex addiction. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. So, and we kind of touched on this already, but so is sex addiction, is it an addiction? Is it an impulse control problem? Is it an obsessive compulsive problem? What is it?
Right. So it starts with, you know, most addictions start with a compulsion, a need, a drive, and then they become impulsive, and then they become addiction. And what that really is saying is that it changes your brain. It changes the way your brain's reward systems work. It changes the way that you function, so that, yes, you have choice, but your choice is very limited and very quick. And if you combine that with a history of trauma, right, trauma being anything that's not nurturing, abuse, neglect, abandonment, you know, death, you know, all these things, and you combine that with a family history of these things, then it's a recipe for a lot of a different choice, right? A person who has all these predispositions and all this history, their choice on whether sex is going to hit them differently the first time they view porn or based on somebody else, it's different. Mm-hmm. So you have a kid who is taught about how to cross the street, and they step out into the street, they might miss the car even though the car almost hits them, right? If you use that analogy again. But you have a kid with no context, you know, they're getting smacked. And it's the same way neurologically. A kid who has been taught about and educated about sex and pornography and, you know, what's good about it, what's bad about it, what's no shame, like, let's just talk about it. They also have a history with their parents of open communication and love and respect. When they screw up or they step into something or they accidentally Google something or their friend shows them something, you know, their instinct is, I don't like that. I'm going to go tell my parents about it. That feels weird. That feels like a violation of love and trust that my family holds dear. But a kid who has low warmth, has rigid boundaries, has learned to hide their self and get their needs met in other ways from, you know, a young age, they view porn for the first time at 8 or 9 or 12, and it's a recipe for disaster. It's an instant fix neurologically, just like alcohol, just like drugs, mm-hmm. you know, and you can measure the brain. You can view it with an MRI. You can see the parts of the brain change with sex just as much as you can. The thing about sex, too, is it's 20% faster in sticking in your brain, sex and food, than anything else.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you'd mentioned sobriety a little earlier, and I'm sure that there were some listeners that were like, wait a second, we're talking about a behavior. We're not talking about drugs or alcohol, but it changes your brain chemistry, and it can take months, if not longer, for your brain chemistry to return to normal. And many of those same areas that are activated by drugs are activated when we view pornography, or when we have a sex addiction, or we have a eating addiction, mm-hmm. you know, so it's very similar type of mechanisms if you look at the brain
for
functioning.
Sure. Yeah. The only difference is that the sex and the food are needs, and they're sensate. You know, they stimulate us more and are actually quicker and worse.
So what are the typical withdrawal symptoms from sex addiction?
So a lot of times what I see, and we can, you know, we talk about kind of sex addiction typically has like 80% of sex addicts have another addiction as well. And so what I see a lot of times, because food and sex are in the similar neuropathways as nicotine and other things, you know, they pick up other habits.
Yeah.
That's why we see, you know, an AA group, everybody's smoking cigarettes mm-hmm. and drinking coffee, mm-hmm. which is, I guess, better.
Yeah.
But you're still neurologically in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you see is, you know, irritability, anger, frustration, lethargy, you know, being tired, you know, some people white knuckle it. It just depends on the person and their history. Some people feel a quick sense of like euphoria. You know, they're like, this is the best thing I've ever done. I'm never going to do this again. and then they open up really quickly, and then all of a sudden, you know, after that euphoria starts settling and their brain starts getting balanced, they're like, you know, that was way too much. Now I'm really scared.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that addiction in general has component of is fear. You know, it's a survival instinct. And so we're afraid that we're going to lose connection, especially with sex and food, that we're going to lose, you know, safety. And so, you know, those symptoms come out in all kinds of ways, depending on the personality, you know, but those are some of the typical ones.
Mm-hmm. So with drug addiction, alcohol addiction, often we'll see a tolerance that develops. And so the person needs more and more of that substance in order to achieve the same kind of high. So is there a similar type of mechanism with sex addiction?
Yeah, there definitely is. Because with sex addiction, you know, and I want to talk about, just say this too, there is a distinct difference in my brain. There's some discussion about this in the culture, but between porn addiction and sex addiction, or porn compulsivity and porn use and sex addiction. What we're talking about is specific sex addiction that fits all this criteria. And it always escalates. It starts out with a subtle, I'm looking at, you know, way women too much and thinking about having sex with them. And they're also like the ones, you know, the people who make it, you know, give a hug and then, you know, their fingers rub somewhere they shouldn't. You know, it's little subtle things that then build into groping, that then build into, you know, masturbation, that then build into pornography. And then it not only am I watching porn, but I'm watching porn and masturbating and cheating. Mm-hmm. And then I'm prostituting. And now I'm doing drugs and getting drunk. And, you know, it's just it on and on and on, you know, I'm doing it at work. Now I'm doing it, you know, in my car. And, you know, it's just more and more and more, mm-hmm. because they need the high. They're chasing the high. And what's crazy is that with addiction, we think that we're getting these dopamine hits and getting high, but we're really, once we get into the cycle, our brain can't produce any more dopamine, mm-hmm. and we're just really avoiding withdrawal.
Yeah.
Like, we just don't want to crash, you know, neurologically. So we think, you know, and the new research is showing basically like your brain's pretty fried. And so all you're doing is trying to keep yourself from crashing. Mm-hmm. It's not that you're actually producing any more dopamine than you were because you're so depleted. And that's why, when people get in recovery, that's those symptoms come out, because now their body has to recalibrate and get dopamine going and try to balance out. The problem with that is if sex is about the orgasm, is about the high, then you're always chasing that. And, I tell a lot of, you know, guys and ladies, like, your orgasm's never going to be good with real intimate sex as it was with porn, if that's your goal. Because the goal of sex is intimacy and connection and security and safety. It's not who can have the best orgasm. Because, mm-hmm. of course, if you're watching porn and you're having sex and you're doing all these things at the same time, or you're having multiple partners, your stimulation and your arousal and all these things are going to be way better physically than with one person.
Yeah.
But that's not the goal. So you have to change the addict's brain around what the goal is. And all that feeds into the narcissism and the wounding and these things that are like, I need to be my needs met. And I'm going to do it however I can with as many people as I can, despite how they feel, mm-hmm. to get these needs met so I can live.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, but I think it's worth exploring some more. So we don't need cocaine. We don't need alcohol, right. but we need food, and sex is a healthy part of life.
For sure.
You know, it's something that we don't necessarily need it to survive day to day, but it is part of being a healthy, happy human being. So how do you...
Well, we need it to survive as a species.
As a species, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So intrinsically, right, even if we... Let's say you got in a wreck, mm-hmm. right, and you couldn't have sex physically, right? Or you have cancer, or you have something you're going with, and you're just not going to have sex. Like, yes, you can live, mm-hmm. but you're... Like, within your marriage, it's going to struggle,
sure.
in some areas that's very difficult because you were designed, mm-hmm. to do that. And then innately, you need to procreate so that we can survive as a species. Mm-hmm. So there's just this intrinsic survival mechanism that kicks in that says, you know, you need to do this.
So how does someone deal with an addiction to something that they need?
Right. So that's the hard part, right? So if you're, all of it's hard, and I'm not belittling any other addiction over others. I'm just out of the mouth of the acts that I work with, you know, with alcohol, it's hard. There's a lot of triggers. There are a lot of things in our culture that it's around drinking. I mean, mm-hmm. you watch Super Bowl and every, you know, thing is a Bud Light commercial, yeah. or sex, you know, and so, but you cannot go to the bar. as a sex addict, as a food addict, like, you have to eat. Mm-hmm. You're going to have sexual urges. You're going to have these hormones. So it makes it more difficult. So, again, you have to do more around this culture of care, this understanding of how did you package sex? How was that, you know, taught to you? How did you develop as a child? How do you view what's good and bad about it? How do you view men and women that are good and bad? You know, there's all these layers with behavior things, with behavioral addictions. But with alcohol, like, that all plays into it. But there's a lot of layers of that that just aren't there, mm-hmm. that aren't intrinsic in who we are and our worth and value. Sex and food has a lot to do with deep down belief system about who am I. Alcohol, cocaine, it doesn't really have that same intrinsic value. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to call in with a question or a comment. Our conversation this evening is on sex addiction, and the number is 1-800-552-8502. So I'm going to ask you a very simple question that has a very complex response. So what causes sex addiction?
Yeah, a lot of things. I would say the typical thing that I see, and it's funny, and you probably experienced this too, just in counseling in general, you know, when you have this information, when you've learned and you've seen enough clients and you've walked with it, it's like people come in the first couple of sessions, they're like, I'm like, no, I don't have your diary, but this is just how it is, right? There's not that much of a variable.
Yeah.
We think we're super unique, and our stories are unique and very special, but like, we kind of behave the same way in a variety of about four ways.
Yeah.
You know? And so with sex addiction, I think it starts with, usually I'd say upwards of 89% of people who have a sex addiction have some emotional neglect, have, you know, there's tears, right? So if you just watch porn, that's kind of a first tier behavior. If you do voyeurism where you're flashing people and watching people, that's a second tier behavior. And then third tier is harming other people. So depending on what tier you're in, depends on what kind of history you typically have. You know, if you're in tier two where you're doing voyeurism and you're peeking in on people and you're flashing people, you usually had some violation yourself. You usually had some early childhood sexual abuse, and now through trauma repetition, you're playing that out, intrinsically getting power from using sex. Whereas in sex addiction, maybe early exposure, you know, lack of attachment, you know, lack of history of awareness. And then lastly, with pedophilia or, you know, child abuse or sexual abuse, you have all of that mixed with a history of that, mixed with trauma, mixed with, you know, other addictions that are playing into it. And so low warmth and rigid parenting. So usually a kid who wasn't told they were loved very often, wasn't nurtured and hugged very often, you know, mixed with very rigid boundaries. But that varies. There may be other people who had, you know, lots of warmth, but still very, very rigid boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so early on, what happens is a thing that we call splitting. The child who doesn't know any better starts to internalize the lack of communication or the communication they're receiving, and they start to blame themselves, right? And this happens before they even see porn or sex is even a thing. And we were talking about this earlier, you know, 4 and 5 year olds, they're not walking around thinking about pornography and thinking about sex. Mm-hmm. They're only thinking about that if they've seen it or been exposed to it or heard about it, because they don't have the anatomy to, their biology doesn't think that way. So there's a 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, you know, prepubescent kid who is really stimulated by sex. They've viewed it. They've seen it. They've heard it. Things have been done to them. And 9 times out of 10, the sex addict is telling you that story. I viewed porn at 8, you know, oh, I found it in a duffel bag in my dad's closet. So when you, as an 8-year-old kid, find a duffel bag of porn in your dad's closet, it communicates something to you. One is, porn's okay. And if you want a connection with your dad, you want to be like your dad, then you do what your dad does. But then you also realize, like, dad's never actually talked to me about this, so we don't talk about this. So now I'm going to sneak, and I'm going to watch it, you know, and I'm talking about from my era, so, and we'll talk about that, but it's like, you know, you had to go get magazines and VHS.
Back when it took effort.
Yeah, you had to go to the store or sneak and find it in your dad's closet. But when I'm talking, you know, I'm treating a lot of adults, and so, you know, they're telling me these stories and these histories of, I found it in my dad's closet, I found this magazine out in the woods, I found, you know, my friend brought it to the camp, whatever. But because of that lack of attachment and that lack of warmth and that lack of connection and understanding, neurologically, it's an instant self-soothing thing. And because you need it and because you have to have it in its survival, It instantly forms neuropathways in your brain that give you pleasure that's bigger than anything you've ever received, and it gives you a false sense of intimacy and a false sense of self. And, you know, if you don't have the skill or the understanding, then after that, you know, preoccupation kicks in, after you act out, there's this huge dump of shame, and you feel horrible and terrible, and you're saying, I'm never going to do it again. But man, after about 45 minutes or 2 hours or a day, that dopamine receptor starts kicking back in, and you start going, well, it wasn't that bad. I'm not that bad. Like, these are their justifications, and it's fine, and blah, blah, blah. Not to mention, in between, if you had an interaction with that father who was, you know, or that mother who was negative, and then you wanted to go self-soothe again, you found a perfect thing to do it with that no one has to intrude in, that's perfectly private. You know, the same thing with food. You can sneak food. You can eat food. Nobody's really asking you, did you eat two more cupcakes than you should?
Yeah. So does sex addiction differ in men and women, or is it the same?
There's higher statistically, men are higher statistically sex addicts than women. What we're seeing in our culture is that, you know, that more women are becoming sex addicts. I think the statistics are, you know, much higher in women now than they used to be. Again, I think it's more about intimacy disorder, and, you know, the co-addiction is love addiction. So there's usually a love addict version of that. And that's a whole nother topic we can talk about that's different than sexual addiction, but a lot more women are love addicts than sex addicts. And I think that's partly because of wiring. Just biological testosterone versus estrogen.
Sure.
Men are typically more visual and women are typically more relational. And so porn, sex is usually all about, like we said, that sensate, what's it dressed up in. You know, and if we look over the history of our culture, like, we dress chairs up so that the legs barely show because we don't want to be erotic. You know, it's insane, right? we pull blankets off of food at Thanksgiving. We take the little case off of the food and we show it. And so it's like men are so much more visually stimulated typically than women are. And so I think that's probably why sex is into that way.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on sex addiction. Please call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So again, we've already kind of touched on this a little bit, but I think there's a lot to say about the media and the impact that what seems like ubiquitous sexual content within the media. I mean, how does that impact sex addiction?
Yeah, so let's talk about our culture for a second. So I'm going to kind of paint a picture. We have a 52%-ish divorce rate, right, which is a trauma. You know, we don't acknowledge that because it's, again, that normal, not healthy. We measure it as normal. So obviously, my parents were divorced and I was fine, but we're not. We have this culture of broken homes and broken families, which means lack of supervision, lack of attachment, lack of affection, you know, typically, which means parents have some addictions that they're dealing with and some issues that they're dealing with. And then you, a history of that in their own family. And then you mix that with advertising that is specifically advertising sex to children. You know, we put some pictures up the other day, and, you know, there was a Burger King ad, and it was a big, long sandwich and this woman with her mouth open, and it said, you know, it tastes the best, you know, and just these, you know, these little subtle or not so subtle ads. There was a Volkswagen Beetle commercial, right? And it said topless, and above the convertible was down, and above it was like blurred out, like it was breast blurred out. And who's that advertising to? Like, who drives around Volkswagen Beetles? Like, I'm not.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, women, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, people going to college, like, and it's, you know, it's saying certain things. Dolce & Gabbana ad that has this lady pinned down with her legs up and four guys standing around with their shirts off looking, and she's smiling. You know, these are very not so subtle, but when we're continually seeing these things, we're desensitized. You know, we're desensitized to violence, and we're desensitized to sex in this culture. And so, you know, these... Some may call you a prude if you start talking about that kind of stuff. Like, oh, well, don't be sex negative. Sex is great. Sex is wonderful. We're talking about very unhealthy sex.
Yeah.
We're talking about giving people visual stimulations in ways that are completely unnecessary to make money. And so that's the simplistic version of it. Then you add in, you know, I think since 1994, sex scenes have increased like 70% in television. That's not very long. And so we you know, I think it was like over 4 hours, there's, you know, 16 sex scenes within a time period on cable television. You know, you can show everything but penetration in the nipple. Like, literally. You know, you're on FX at 7 o'clock and there's a sex scene with full-on nudity other than those two things. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that 10, 15 years ago. And so we're so inundated with this material that we're getting used to it. And, you know, when people are, you know, sharing different movies and different genres of things on Facebook and saying, this was great, and then somebody clicks on it, it's like, oh, there's a sex scene every 15 minutes in this show, but let's just ignore it because the plot's good.
Yeah.
You know, but we're not seeing what that's doing mm-hmm. to our brains and to our culture mm-hmm. and, you know, what that message is sending to kids and children. And so, yeah, that's part of it. The other part is what keeps an addiction going. Sex addiction is, you know, kind of the three A's: accessibility, affordability, and accountability. And what's gone completely out of the window in the last 10 years? Those three things. Mm-hmm. You can have your smartphone. I mean, I could be literally, you can't see my phone in my hand right now. I could be looking at porn while we're sitting in the, and people do.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they wherever you're at on a daily basis, someone's looking at porn around you. You know, and if they're not, they're going to.
Yeah.
It's like illegal in like 4 states now to give your kid access to the internet and a cell phone without some kind of supervision app. And I think that's super smart.
Yeah.
Like, when did we get to a culture where people's individual freedoms, right, and these rights, like, trump good for them? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying like we should police everything. I'm just saying when you don't protect children, then we're not protecting ourselves. We're not protecting our future. And kids should not have a smartphone without supervision.
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't allow kids to drive because they don't have the motor skills. They don't have the visual skills. They don't have the, you know, I mean, there's just a whole plethora of reasons why we don't let kids drive. But we give them, you know, this phone where they can access pornography, which they're also not ready for.
For sure.
They're not ready to drive. They're not ready to view pornography, especially the kind of porn we have now.
Yeah, they're not ready to be handed something where they can find anything they need.
Yeah.
Because this is the thing. Even if they're a kid who's like, oh, I'm just going to look for boobs because somebody said boobs or somebody said
BJ. You're going to get a lot more than boobs.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to see what this is. Kids are curious. It's their job to be curious.
Sure.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. And the thing about sex and porn is that something can be arousing and disgust you at the same time. Mm-hmm. I have kids in my office who are like, I don't want to watch this stuff because it's disgusting, but I'm so aroused and turned on by it. And Patrick Carnes coined that arousal template phrase. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that early on, all these things we've been talking about with attachment and connection, something along the lines hits us and there's this arousal template that's formed, and that's the thing that turns us on.
Yeah.
So when we talk about those other philias, that's about that. You know, they're turned on by certain things because of a history of other things. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that's always bad or that's always negative. But when those things become a problem and then we can share them with everybody in the culture at any point we want to without context, then it's dangerous.
So I want to remind our listeners that we are talking about sex addiction this evening. So just want to give everybody a little warning. Probably not a good topic to listen with the kiddos. But I do want to invite our listeners to call in and give us a question or a comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So we've already kind of talked about pornography, but it's so accessible. And it is very different than your father's pornography.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts about how pornography impacts sex addiction?
Yeah, I mean, it fuels it, you know, because the reality is that, I mean, most sex addicts are watching porn. I mean, like, when I say most, like a large mm-hmm. majority. Not all porn viewers are sex addicts, but most of the ones who are sex addicts are 100% watching porn because they started watching it so long ago. You know, from 12 to 18, we are developing as many synapses as we ever are, which means our connections to our responses and the way we do life and the way we do relationships. And right now, child, you know, viewing pornography, average view is around 8 or 9. Some say as low as 6. Now, that doesn't mean the 8 and 9 year olds getting on there and watching every day, although a large majority of them are. But it goes back to only 18% of parents have rules for cell phone devices. Out of those 18%, I know I'm not the most consistent mm-hmm. parent in the world. I try to be. But out of those 18%, they have rules, but do they actually apply them?
Sure.
So you have this very low number of people who are actually supervising and watching their kids, and that's causing so much of an epidemic long term. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as we move forward, we have to do something about pornography, but we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
We all know it's out there. There's, I mean, I was watching Friends, right, as a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Like, we were watching old episodes of Friends the other day, and, you know, Joey's talking about something about, well, don't, you know, record over my porn, mm-hmm. and everybody laughs. But it's like, porn isn't this soft, gentle subject of sex. You know, 80% of the things are violence against women, you know, and I'm not going to get into all the details of that, like, on the radio, but the reality is those things are not real. And we're teaching people to be completely disassociated from reality by watching these things. And some might say that's sex negative. Like, well, it's fine to watch porn with my spouse if we both agree. And the question would be, well, why? Why do you need that extra? And I'm not saying that's totally always wrong, but the discussion about it mm-hmm. has to be, you know, both parties.
Yeah. So we have James from North Louisiana. Go right ahead with your question or comment, James.
I'm a 60-year-old male, and I started looking at the Sears catalog back when I was about 14, and it's progressed from there all the way up to the point where I'm still watching it now, and it's cost me one marriage, end up costing me another. I've wanted to stop for about the past 5 years, and I've tried many, many times to stop watching porn, and I
want
to know how to stop.
Well, I think a good first step is to get a good therapist who is experienced in treating pornography addiction, because it's really a very specialized area, and yes. You need somebody who really understands it, understands the neurochemistry involved, understands what the triggers are going to be, understands how to treat this really effectively. So I think that that's a good first step. And then also finding a support group. There are people out there who are struggling with the same, lots of people who are struggling with the same kind of thing. So I think that's a good second step. And Clint, any other suggestions?
Yeah, I think you took the first step tonight, James. I mean, that's super incredible for you to call in and be that open and vulnerable. And, you know, we get to the place where we need help and we need to reach out. And, you know, there's great power in vulnerability. It doesn't make sense, but when you do it, there's freedom. And so, yeah, I just ask you to call somebody and get some help around your area. You can reach us at, you know, ClintDavisCounseling.com and look at our numbers and, you know, call us and we can put you in touch with another CSAT. You can visit ITAP, IITAP. And International Institute of Trauma and Addiction Professionals. And you can type in an area code and it'll show you a CSAT around your area or somebody who works in sex addiction. But yes, you definitely need to find somebody who does this every day so that they can connect with you on a level, because when they don't, they can do more damage than good.
Yeah. So we have another caller. We have Bill from Shreveport. Bill, go right ahead with your question or comment.
I was wondering if masturbation would desensitize a man's penis.
Obsessive masturbation, yes. And that's, you know, that's a large topic on all kinds of areas. If masturbation's good, if it's healthy, but, you know, the question is it, will it desensitize your penis? Yes. If you obsessively masturbate time and time again and pornography, what we're seeing a lot in younger and older men is erectile dysfunction mm-hmm. because they cannot get an erection yeah. without a screen, without the stimulation.
I'm seeing teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
People in their 20s.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, you can. I'd say, you know, you can see a doctor, you can look at your testosterone levels, you can look at a lot of things, but, you know, part of addiction, part of compulsivity, part of trauma is wanting to take care of ourselves, and sex is important, and masturbation is a way to do that, and we can do that in a very narcissistic, unhealthy way, which then causes physical problems.
Well, thank y'all, James and Bill, for your questions and comments. We really appreciate it. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we get to resources, because
yeah.
we've kind of had to skip some things because we both obviously enjoy talking about this topic. So what resources are available? If people are struggling with this, what can they do?
Yeah, so they can call you.
Sure.
They can call us. Calling in and finding, like I said, going on the website, going on Google and typing in sex addiction therapist and looking for somebody who's specifically trained. Go to a pastor in this area and, you know, open up, you know, with whoever your religious authority is and get them to direct you in the right direction. Hopefully they have a good solution. you know, get online and look. Come visit us at Clint Davis Counseling. We have multiple CSATs on staff who can see you. That would be my main. That's what can help.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't know what's going on with you, it's good to come in and just talk about it and get an assessment. It's confidential. It's somebody who's not going to judge you. And so you can come in and say, hey, I don't really know if I'm a sex addict, but I struggle in these areas. And I just want everybody to just remember that it's not about the sex. It's about this intimacy issue. It's about not being able to connect and feeling afraid. And so the answer to that, right, even though it's counterintuitive, is to be vulnerable, is to open up. You cannot love another person without vulnerability, right? If I say, you know, I love you, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you're going to say
sure.
it back.
Yeah.
And so it takes vulnerability, and healing is the same way to get in recovery and to recover from addiction or drug addiction or from trauma. You have to be vulnerable. But our instinct is to avoid, and that's a human mm-hmm. nature condition, right? And for me as a Christian, you know, I use Jesus as an example for that because before the cross, he said, Father, if there's any other way, take this cup from me. It wasn't a sin that Jesus wanted to avoid the worst way possible to die. He just, if there was another way. And a lot of times that's what we want. We want the easy fix. And our culture fills us with all this stuff of, this is the easy fix, just mm-hmm. do this. And with this, there's not an easy solution.
Yeah, because often I'll have patients come in and, you know, is there a pill I can take? Well, there may be, but it's not going to fix it.
Right. It's going to treat your symptom, not your belief system and your worth and value issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So any other suggestions, or we've got about a minute left, any other words of wisdom for our listeners?
Yeah, I would say most things that are a problem that I see in my office are people trying to get worth and value internally from external things, mm-hmm. trying to find a worth and value in things that are work and value related. And the reality is that we as human beings, we have to do one thing to have worth and value, and that's breathe. That God says that we have worth and value because of who He is and who we are, and that if we can start to believe that, it changes our brain and our neurochemistry, that changes our thoughts and feelings, and that changes our behavior.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening. I really appreciate your time and your expertise. If you would, one more time, give your contact information so that people know how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, it's ClintDavisCounseling.com, and you can call us at 318-562-6903 or shoot us an email at ClintDavisCounseling@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for being with us, Clint.
Thank you.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, and production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Sheila Lawrence. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.